Well, greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 120 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on understanding limited liability when we come back. You know, people call the law school here regularly and they ask how they can learn more about the topics that I speak on over the air. Well, every topic that I cover here on the air, I teach in detail in one of my classes. These classes are tailored for busy people in every walk of life, people just like you. For example, the origin of the common law. How is the common law applicable today? And how do we use the common law in court? How do we use the common law on the street or at home or at work? Where did it come from? And of what value is the common law in the 21st century? Well, the common law is important because it affects your status, and your status is how you're being taxed. And it's important because it affects your property or your lack of property. This common law is the first of 46 lessons in my tax and status school. And we have three goals. First is stay out of jail. Second, save your assets. Third, solve your tax problem once and for all time. If you want to live your life peaceably and be left alone, then this tax and status class is for you. Why don't you write today or call or wire and ask for my free general law CD package, and I'll show you why the common law is so important to you and in so many different ways. Now, if you'd like more information about our tax and status school, why don't you call and order a free general law CD package? You know, that's a place to start. Doesn't cost you anything. And it's a four-hour commentary on the law in general. It's educational, it's informative, it's entertaining. Best of all, it's free, and you can call and order one. And the number is 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, our tax and status school is also available on compact disc for adult home study. And if you're online, you can go to our website, georgegordon.org. Just click onto the archives page, georgegordon.org. Click onto the archives page, and you can download that free general law CD package right there. Understanding limited liability. Well, first of all, if you've got a pen and paper out there, just write this down. Limited liability is insurance. That's how simple that is, limited liability insurance. Insurance violates the biblical law because the biblical law requires that you practice strict liability. Write that down. You've got limited liability, and we've got strict liability. Now, most of us are pretty familiar with insurance. We buy insurance for health, fire, flood, derivatives, auto, homeowners, and sometimes we even practice self-insurance. We'll talk about self-insurance as we progress along, but there's an insurance policy or an insurance plan for just about every potential calamity or catastrophe that you could imagine. Insurance is a very profitable enterprise. It's a very profitable business, and that's why so much of it is being sold. But there is a legal side to this thing called insurance. Yes, sir? There are some legal liabilities. When you buy an insurance policy, you've got some adhesion contract there that you might not understand. It's kind of like that check story that we talked about here a week or two ago. And once you take a look at that check story and you understand those checks, then all of a sudden you have a new confrontation. Do I really want to participate in guaranteeing the maker of the check's credit? And insurance is about the same. Do I really want to engage in this kind of limited liability scheme, this kind of criminal activity, which has some side effects to it? So let's start with limited liability as it relates to the guardian-ward relationship. Guardian and ward. Now, we kind of know what guardians are. As parents who have children, we're called guardians. And we have a duty. The law imposes upon us a duty to protect those children from events or from hazards and liabilities that might occur to them that they would not reasonably be able to foresee. For instance, the other day, there was a little piece on the news. A truck driver is driving down the street, and there's a little kid playing out in the middle of the street. I mean, little kid, about 18 months old, still in diapers. So the truck driver stops his truck, jumps out, grabs the little kid, and then starts knocking on doors to find out whose kid this is. And pretty soon, there's a parent that says, "Oh, yeah, that's my kid." And so he takes the kid, goes in the house, and nothing more is said. Well, the truck driver was a little bit put out, so he called social aid, and he said, "I was driving down the street, and there's this little kid out in the street. I picked the kid up, knocked on a couple of doors. I found the parents, and the parent took the kid into the house, never said thank you, go to hell, or jack squat, so I thought I'd have called you. I don't know if this is normal." Well, social aid comes out, snatches the kid, puts it in foster care, and there's where that story's at. There's a guardian-ward relationship operating here. The truck driver probably doesn't understand it. He participated in it, and maybe rightfully so. The parents of the child, they're the victims of it, probably don't understand how it works, and probably rightly so. Maybe that child does need to be removed from that home. I mean, I can't say one way or the other. You know, things happen, but normally we don't let children play out in the street, especially when they're 18 months old. But the purpose of the exercise here is to remind you that that parent had a duty to keep that child out of the street, didn't he? And he failed to carry out that duty. Now there are consequences that come down. Child has to be taken away. Furthermore, there may be prosecutions that come down. There may be jail time. There could be fines. There could be loss of the child. Now, those parents had a choice to make, and maybe they were busy doing other things, but you know, did you have a greater duty to be looking out for the child, or did you have a greater duty to be doing whatever it was you were doing that you didn't watch the child, and the child wandered off into the street and started to play? Again, life is made up of choices, and sometimes we make bad choices. Now, a guardian, then, is somebody that has duties and obligations. We assume that the guardian has capacity, that the guardian is smart, educated, knowledgeable, wise, beneficent. Now, the ward, on the other hand, is the product or the ward of the guardian, the person being taken care of, the guy that's not very wise, can't look ahead, can't take care of himself, can't watch out, doesn't know that he shouldn't be playing in the street. He's somebody that needs to be awakened in the morning, put to bed at night, and told what to do in between. In other words, the guardian is the boss, and the ward is the employee. The guardian is the master, and the ward is the subject. Well, now the question arises, well, what are you in your life's experience? Are you the guardian, or are you the ward? And could you tell the difference between the guardian and the ward? Do you even know what your position is? Well, looking in the American Jurisprudence Legal Dictionary, or in this case, Legal Encyclopedia, when we look at guardian, we find the definition and nature of a guardian as a trust relation of the most sacred character in which one person called a guardian acts for another called the ward, whom the law regards as incapable of managing his own affairs. Boy, that kind of sums up this circumstance, doesn't it? A guardian is a trust relationship of the most sacred character, and I underlined the word sacred because that kind of indicates we get some kind of religious connection here. And then I want to point out that this is from the American Jurisprudence Encyclopedia. We're not talking about church here, but this is a sacred responsibility in which one person, the parent, is called a guardian, who is supposed to act for the other, called the ward, that's the child, whom the law regards as incapable of managing his own affairs. The ward is unable to determine that he ought not to be playing in the street. Now, a curator, you got a guardianship here, number one. A curator is a guardian appointed by the court to control property of a minor, and he's not a guardian of the person. And in some jurisdictions, a conservator may be appointed. He has the same powers and obligations as a guardian so far as they relate to the property of the ward, so that in effect he is a guardian of the ward's estate. All right, now one time, little Georgie Gordon had a bicycle, and Georgie's bicycle was, in my view, my property. And when somebody said to me, whose bicycle is that? I'd say, that's my bicycle. Now, one day I misbehaved, and my daddy, who was my guardian, said to me, you're grounded, and you're not to ride your bicycle for a week. So I had to park my bicycle on the porch and walk. And I was a paper boy at the time. Boy, you talk about punishment. I had to walk my entire paper route and deliver all of my papers by hand. I couldn't ride my bike and throw them, you know. It was terrible. Now, let me ask you this. Whose bicycle was it? You see, I thought it was my bicycle, and I said it was my bicycle, and my dad would have told you that's my boy George's bicycle, but the reality of it was my daddy owned me. He was my guardian. And kind of by default, all of my property is in the hands of my curator, my daddy, who can take it away from me, give me more of it, or regulate it and control it in any way he desires. There's a guardian-ward relationship in the fullest sense of the word there. And notice how it affects my property. The ward may have an automobile, a home, or he may have chattels, but if he has a guardian, the guardian then becomes the curator, and the curator can tell that ward how to use that property. That's kind of like the highway patrolman. That's kind of like the state telling you drive your car 55, pay this for the registration, you have to have a driver's license and insurance, and etc. It's a guardian-ward relationship. Now, in the guardian-ward relationship, we find that banks, insurance companies, government, employers, unions, lawyers, doctors, hospitals, schools, and colleges, those are just some samples of guardians over people. Example, the bank is the guardian of fiscally irresponsible people who can't take care of their money. And so they have to guide these people. They have to take their money and put it in checking accounts and dole it out a little at a time. They have to take their money and put it in savings accounts because these people can't save it themselves. They have to loan these people money and charge them a fee to manage their houses. And, you know, it just goes on and on. Insurance companies do the same thing. People who cannot be responsible and take care of themselves need a guardian. And so we go to the insurance company and we declare ourselves to be incompetent of managing events that are beyond our control. My God, I might lose my job, so I need unemployment insurance. I might break my leg on the job, therefore I need workman's compensation insurance. Oh my God, a tornado might come and knock my house down, and therefore I need somebody to rebuild my house. I couldn't do that by myself. I can't handle my negotiations with my employer, so I need a union guardian. I can't support myself, so I need an employer guardian. I can't handle my own medical affairs, so I need a doctor guardian, who in turn may have to put me into the hospital to take care of me. I can't educate myself, so I need a school guardian, and I need more education, so I need a college guardian, and on it goes. And every time you approach one of these institutions, did you ever notice you have to sign your name? There's something about the signing your name. That's where you give your power of attorney. That's where you create the guardian-ward relationship. Every time you sign your name, you impair your liberty to some degree. So when we go to the insurance company and we sign up for this policy, we're declaring ourselves to be wards of the insurance company in a guardian-ward relationship. Now, each one of these guardian-ward relationships is limited. It isn't all-encompassing. I mean, the insurance company isn't going to interfere with your employer and union relationship or your government citizen tax relationship or your legal relationship with your lawyer, but they're going to control you in regards to some element of your life. Now, let me give you an experience that I had. I used to run a company called the Atlantis Manufacturing Company. Now, I've got 30 employees, and I'm producing about a little over $1 million a year, and I'm paying $200,000 a year in taxes. I'm making pretty good money. I don't see myself as being a ward, but I had to have fire insurance. Fire insurance, got to have it. So in the fire insurance policy, they sent a man by twice a year, and he would come into the plant, and he would inspect it. And when he'd get through with his inspection, he'd come by my office, and he'd say, "Now, Mr. Gordon, I found these deficiencies. Now, I'm going to come back in 2 weeks, and if I find that these deficiencies are not corrected, then we will take action, and we may cancel your policy, or we may raise your rates. But if I come back in 2 weeks and these deficiencies have been corrected, then there will be no need to raise your rates or cancel your policies." Now, I didn't put it in quite those terms, but, you know, he could have said, "You know, the choice is yours. You know, make up your mind, decide what you want to do, and I'll see you in 2 weeks." Now, what this man was doing, he would come by and say, "Look, you're not competent and capable of determining what it is you need to do or not do in order to protect yourself from fire." Fire inspectors come in and they say, "Well, let us inspect your fire extinguishers and smoke detectors, because without me, your guardian, you wouldn't have fire extinguishers to put out a fire. You wouldn't have smoke detectors, or the batteries would be dead. I have to come by and act as your guardian and tell you what to do and when to do it." And that's essentially what a guardian does. He tells his ward what to do and when to do it. Now, maybe you hadn't thought of it in those terms before, but that's exactly what a guardian does. He tells somebody who may be of sound mind, may be somebody that has a lot of money, prestige, power, authority, but he's still telling this guy how to live his life and what to do, which is the antithesis of freedom and liberty. Freedom and liberty is embodied in your making that choice and decision. And we would presume that if you're throwing oily rags around in corners, you must be doing so because you want to. And when you, the owner of the company, are walking around your plant, can't you see oily rags in the corner and then tell somebody to pick them up, put them in a metal barrel, and put a metal lid over the top of them? Well, if you can't, you can rest assured that the fire inspector will, or the insurance inspector will. All right, so there's the guardian-ward relationship. Now, the purpose of statutes relating to guardianship is to safeguard the rights and interests of minors and incompetent persons, and the courts should be vigilant to see that the rights of such persons are properly protected. The court, having jurisdiction of a guardianship matter, is said to be the superior guardian, while the guardian himself is deemed to be an officer of the court. Notice the term incompetent persons. Well, I was certainly incompetent. I needed the fire inspector to come by and tell me to put my fire extinguishers out, recharge them, and put batteries in my smoke detectors. And I needed the insurance company fire inspector, the insurance inspector, to come by and tell me about the oily rags and the fire doors and, and the other safety aspects of my factoring. Now, that's what the guardian-ward relationship is all about. That's the definition of it. That's the way it works. And then in the final analysis, in several states, statutes authorize a person who, although of sound mind, when he believes that he is incapable of managing his own estate or of caring for his own property, he may apply for, request, or simply consent to the appointment of a conservator or a guardian of his estate or of his person or both, who, when appointed, possesses over the estate substantially the same powers and is subject in regard thereto to substantially the same duties as the guardian of an incompetent. See, you don't have to be incompetent to apply for, request, or consent to the appointment of a conservator. Think about it. You don't have to be incompetent to go to a doctor and say, I can't take care of my medical needs. I can't take care of my own body. And I need you to do that for me. I need you to tell me that I'm smoking too much, or that I need to exercise more, or that I need to take this or that pill to reduce my high blood pressure, or. I'm medically incompetent. Or you go to a lawyer and you say, gee, I'm legally incompetent. I'm being sued by this guy and I haven't got a clue as to what I should do next. I don't know the rules of court. I don't know how to answer a complaint. And I have to have a guardian, and so let me come in here, sign an agreement with you, pay you money, and have you represent me in this matter. And you go to the bank, you do the same thing with the bank, insurance company, government, employers, unions, lawyers, doctors, hospitals, schools, and colleges. And that's the tip of the iceberg. Every time you sign your name somewhere, you're saying, I'm incompetent and unable to do this. Now, we call this trade, commerce, business, and industry. Just the other day, I took my car over to Mike, the mechanic. And I had to declare myself to be mechanically incompetent and unable to make my car work. Mike, let me hire you as my guardian, and you fix my car. He did, charged me money, and I left. I had to sign a piece of paper and give him the authority to fix it. Had to enter into a legal agreement that bound me to specific performance. Hey, this thing of insurance is starting to smell already, isn't it? Not only does it cost you a lot of money, it also costs you your liberty, and there can be some consequences beyond that that perhaps you don't even recognize, some legal consequences that nobody's ever told you about. All right, let's take a look at another story. Let's go back in time. Let's go back to Boise County, Idaho. And there's a story that comes down about the turn of the century. And leaving Boise, Idaho is a wagon, and it's being driven by a teamster. Today we'd call him a truck driver, but this is back in the olden days, and this guy's a teamster. And he's got four horses, four big Percheron horses, and he's pulling this big, heavy drayage wagon, and he's hauling cargo, and he's taking it up to Idaho City. Now, at the same time, up in Idaho City, there's a farmer with his wife and two children, a couple of girls, and he wants to go to Boise. And they're going to go on a shopping trip, and they leave early in the morning. And they're going to drive their team along with their surrey. They're riding in a surrey with the fringe on top. And they're going to Boise to go shopping. This is a farmer, successful, owns his farm. He has some cattle. He's raising crops, and he's selling it to the miners, and he's financially successful, and he's happy as a clam at high tide. But he doesn't have any insurance. And in 1900, limited liability only applies to trade, commerce, business, and industry. It is true that ships and ship owners and businesses and corporations practice insurance, but common people don't. In 1900, you know, the average Joe Sixpack, he doesn't have health insurance, fire insurance, flood insurance, derivative, auto, homeowners insurance, life insurance. He doesn't do that. He practices strict liability. If he causes a damage to somebody, he has to pay for it, all of it. Now, businesses under the Limited Liability Act of 1851 now are some, they're a breed of another stripe. And this drayage, the Acme Drayage Company, they have insurance. And they're represented, you know, by Mutual of Omaha or the Travelers or somebody else, Lloyd's of London. Now, the driver of the drayage wagon is drunk. He's driving along, he's drinking, and you know. But then in 1900, nobody cared if somebody drove drunk. It wasn't against the law to drive a wagon up the highway drunk. There was no drunk driving law. Didn't need to. The horses know where they're going. They're going to Idaho City. And so as the wagon is plodding along the road coming up to the top of a hill, the farmer in the surrey, being in a hurry to get to town, he's driving his horses furiously. And that's the term that they used to use in the old days when they thought you were speeding, but it didn't make any difference because there weren't any speed laws. It didn't make any difference if you were driving your horses as fast as they could run, or they were trotting, or they were walking. You know, there's no speed law, no stop signs, no stop sign law. We didn't have the kind of traffic laws in 1900 that we have today. Regulation is something that goes along with people that can't take care of themselves. These people are all free. You know, they're making decisions for themselves as they go along. Now, as the farmer is driving his horses furiously, they come around a turn, and the farmer is on the left side of the road, which doesn't make any difference because there aren't any laws that tell you to drive on one side of the road or the other. There isn't any center line. This is a dirt road. Now, the farmer is driving rapidly, furiously, as they said in those days, and a terrible head-on collision occurs. The farmer's team runs into the other team's. The horses on the Acme drayage bolt, and they run away. The wagon is wrecked. It goes over the side of the road, and there's an injury. The drunk driver of the wagon is injured, and the farmer and his wife and their children, there's some injuries there. Now, there's no highway patrolman. There's no ambulance. Nobody's there to give anybody a ticket. But that doesn't mean that there isn't any law here. That doesn't mean that there isn't a remedy. The common law is in full force and effect here. The common law is working. This is what happened in the olden days before we had stop signs and traffic lights and lines down the middle of the road and traffic cops and drunk driver laws. And, you know, everybody is out here just doing his own thing, doing that which is right in his own eyes, as it reports in the book of Judges. Every man did that which was right in his own eyes. And the driver of the wagon didn't see anything wrong with drinking, and the farmer didn't see anything wrong with driving his horses furiously. And there was a blind turn, and all of a sudden there they are, and there's an accident. Now, when all of the pieces are picked up, if somebody here feels that he's been wronged, we could have some litigation. And in this case, and just for the sake of our discussion here, we'll presume that the company, that's the Acme Drayage Company, believes that they've been wronged and that what they need is to sue the farmer because he was driving furiously around a blind turn. He knew or should have known that he should not have been driving his team that fast. The farmer can say, well, the driver of the team over here was drunk and therefore there's contributory negligence. In other words, the common law requires that we have litigation and that we iron all of these issues out in front of a jury, and we'll let the jury decide who's at fault, and should any damages be awarded? While we're thinking about that, let me give you a mid-course reminder here that you're listening to the Law Hour, an editorial review, and that we're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States. We're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Now, the law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. Now, that's 8 schools in all. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals but by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults and compact disc. The Law Hour website is updated weekly and has a radio log schedule and archives, and all of it can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Now, the law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order one by calling and asking for it. The number is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. If you're online, go to our website, georgegordon.org, click onto the archives page, and you can download that free general law CD package right there. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse or recommend books, papers, periodicals, and newsletters to our listeners. These endorsements or recommendations that we give don't mean that the authors or the publications that we're endorsing are necessarily going to reciprocate. Keep in mind that most of these authors and publications that we cite here on the Law Hour may be hostile, political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans, and their viewpoints may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review. These opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine, they're mine alone, and they don't necessarily represent the views, beliefs, or the opinions of the advertiser, sponsors, management, or staff of this radio network or local radio station. Now, if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, we invite you to go to our webpage at georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we are talking about insurance. We're talking about understanding limited liability. Limited liability now is the legal term that we use to describe insurance. Insurance is commerce, and it's regulated and controlled under the Commerce Clause at Article 1, Section 8 here in the United States under our federal constitution. Every state constitution has a provision for regulating and governing commerce. Commerce in the Bible is called Canaanite trafficking, and it's strictly prohibited. In this country, we have chambers of commerce. nearly in every town, county, city, state, nation. Chambers of commerce, chambers of Canaanite trafficking. These are institutions that are designed and dedicated to commercial trading. The Roman law merchant, the Uniform Commercial Code. Insurance is right in there with them. Now, it's prohibited in the scripture. Most people don't care because they don't practice the scriptural law anyway. But I think it would be good for us to all know and understand the limitations and the costs and liabilities that are associated with limited liability, the guardian-ward relationship. All right, now, after the wreck, the Acme company sues the farmer for $10,000, alleging that their driver was injured, their horses were killed, and their cargo was lost, and they want the farmer to pay for it. And they invoke the common law rule that he was driving furiously, practicing strict liability, and that he owes this company, he needs to pay their damages, because he's the proximate cause of their damages. Now, on the part of the farmer, he comes into court and he argues that there wasn't any law that said that he couldn't drive as fast as he wanted around whatever blind turn he proposed, that he was acting responsibly, and that the wagon driver wasn't acting responsibly, and that the wagon driver was drunk. To which the company replies, there isn't any law that says this guy can't drink or that he can't be stoned drunk. He doesn't have to comply with any law like that because there isn't any law in the books. Can you begin to see what some of the problems are here? This is why people like commerce. They like limited liability. They like to know what the rules of the game are, and so they want to hire government to come in and make rules, and so they did. Cases like this is what creates these rules. Public demand comes into play, or the public simply doesn't care, and they don't object to timely. And so you can see here the signal that's being sent. We've got to have drunk driver legislation. We've got to have a center line down the road. We've got to have highway patrolmen. We've got to have speed limits. We've got to have somebody driving on one side in one direction and somebody driving on the other side in the other direction. We've got to have stop signs and traffic lights. And in short, we need 2,000 traffic codes and rules to govern the use of the highways because it's obvious that we can't do it ourselves. We need some guardians out there with regulation. Hell, the public demands it. It's for the health, safety, and welfare of the public. Right. Now, when the public gets to a point where they cannot take care of themselves, then they need a guardian. I mean, that just goes without saying, doesn't it? All right, so the jury comes back, and they follow all of the common law rules, and they rule in favor of the drayage company. And the farmer now has to pay $10,000 in damages. He doesn't have $10,000. So as a result of that, he then has to sell his farm, or his farm is going to be taken and auctioned off. Now his family is going to be homeless. He's unemployed. They've lost everything that they've got. And so as a result of this, the insurance industry comes out to everybody and they say, now look what happened. They show this accident and they use it in their sales brochures and they say, if this farmer had just had accident insurance, the insurance company would have taken care of this. He didn't have accident insurance and he lost his farm and lost everything he had and now he's homeless. And this is what the insurance industry does. They take the exception, and this doesn't happen very often, and they take this exception, one in 1,000, one in 10,000, one in 100,000. They hold it up and they say, this is why you need auto or accident insurance. And then they sell this insurance to thousands of people who buy it and pay the premiums and never collect a dime, which is the way insurance works. That doesn't mean it's illegal and lawful or some kind of a scam. It means that an entrepreneur is smart enough to add and subtract and say these kinds of accidents that cost $10,000 occur about one in 1,000 cases. We can sell 1,000 policies for $100 a year. And then we're going to have a claim once a year, which we'll have to pay out $10,000 and the profit on it will be $90,000. What's wrong with that? And that's the way insurance works. It's an event that does occur and occurs with predictable frequency. Accidents. And then we have to have insurance to protect us from the consequences. In the process, instead of one man being regulated and controlled, we now have 1,000 people who all have insurance policies who are all being regulated and controlled. All 1,000 people have to give up their rights and freedoms to be regulated by the Highway Patrol and the government and the EPA and OSHA and on it goes because one guy had an accident. And everybody else bought an insurance policy. Everybody joins these regulated enterprises. People who join regulated enterprises can be regulated and controlled, and in fact, they are. Now, let me show you something here about joining a regulated enterprise. It's a case called Almeida Sanchez. And the Supreme Court of the United States said in Almeida Sanchez, cited at 413 U.S., I don't have the front number here, but it's on page 270. So it's going to be United States versus Almeida Sanchez, cited at volume 413, United States Supreme Court Reports, and it's close to page 270 because this is where the key information is located. Now listen to this story. In seeking a rationale for the validity of the search in this case, the government thus understandably sidesteps the automobile search cases, and instead the government relies heavily on cases dealing with administrative inspections. But these cases fail to support the constitutionality of this search. In Camera versus Municipal Court, cited at 387 U.S. 523, the court held that administrative inspections to enforce community health and welfare regulations could be made on less than probable cause to believe that particular dwellings were the sites of particular violations. Yet the court insisted that the inspector obtain either consent or a warrant supported by particular physical and demographic characteristics of the areas to be searched. The search in the present case was conducted in the unfettered discretion of the members of the Border Patrol who did not have a warrant, they did not have probable cause, and they did not have consent. This search thus embodies precisely the evil that the court saw in Camera when it insisted that the discretion of the official in the field be circumscribed by obtaining a warrant prior to the inspection. Now, there are two other administrative inspection cases relied upon by the government that are equally an opposite. The first is Colonnade Catering Corporation versus United States, cited at 397 U.S. 72, and the second is United States versus Biswell, 406 U.S. 311. Both of these cases approved of warrantless inspections of commercial enterprises which were engaged in businesses closely regulated and licensed by the government. In Colonnade Catering, the court stressed the long history of federal regulation and taxation of the manufacture and sale of liquor. In Biswell, the court noted the pervasive system of regulation and reporting imposed upon licensed gun dealers. Now, a central difference between those cases and this case is that businessmen who are engaged in such federally licensed and regulated enterprises accept the burdens as well as the benefits of their trade, whereas the petitioner here was not engaged in any kind of regulated or licensed business. The businessman in a regulated industry, in effect, consents to the restrictions placed upon him. All right, now let's apply that. When you go to the bank and you open a checking account, you become a businessman with the bank. Those business transactions are governed by, at the federal level, Title 31 and Title 12 of the U.S. Code, and the bank knows and understands its limitations and the laws. You don't, but you now have entered this regulated enterprise into a guardian ward relationship in which now the bank takes on the role of your guardian. You take on the role of the ward in a guardian ward relationship. Now one day you decide that you want to make a withdrawal, and you come into the bank and you withdraw $10,000 in small bills. Suddenly you find yourself confronted with government officers asking you, what in the world are you doing with $10,000 in small bills? And you protest, this is America, the land of the free and the home of the brave. I've got rights and I don't have to tell you. Excuse me? Excuse me? Excuse me? You have joined a regulated enterprise. You're a part and parcel with the bank and its business. We want to know all about where you're sending this $10,000 and whether or not you're sending it to Switzerland, and how much you're sending to Switzerland, and why you're sending it to Switzerland. We want to know all about your money laundering activities and your tax avoidance and tax evasion and what's the difference between the two. I mean, after all, you are a licensed businessman and you've joined this regulated enterprise. Now, I know somebody's going to say, I don't have a license. Yes, you do. Yes, 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 you do. You have a license. You see, the bank is a corporation with a charter. They have a business license, and you've joined the bank in their regulated enterprise by adhesion contract when you signed the deposit card for your checking account. Now, if you'll go into the bank and ask for one of those deposit cards, they'll give you one, and you look at the bottom of it, in very fine print, it says, I agree to be bound by all the terms and conditions of Title 31 of the U.S. Code as it relates to regulation of the bank and the Banking Act and Title 12. Be sure you take your 10-power loop with you so you can read the terms and conditions. Now, the terms and conditions are not carried on the card. It simply refers you to Title 31 and Title 12. These are the side effects that you get from the guardian ward relationship when you participate in a regulated enterprise. That's what limited liability is all about. You want to limit your liability, and the reason you put your money in the bank is because you're afraid some bad man's going to take it from you. You're afraid you won't be able to count it correctly. And so you're hiring the bank as your guardian in limited liability so that it limits your liability, and they're going to take it and charge you a fee, and they're going to do this service for you, count your money and pass it around for you, clear your checks, go out and collect them for you. And they provide these services for you, and they charge a fee. That's their business. But it creates a side effect. It creates this guardian-ward relationship in which they become the guardian. Let's try this one. You walk into the bank. You say, I want to close my account. Give me my money today. And the guy says to you, come back in 90 days, and we'll give you your money. But I want it today. Can't have it. Why not? I'm your guardian, and I'm telling you, you can't have it for 90 days. See, it's already written up in the statutes that in the discretion of the bank, if they should decide that they don't want to give you the money today, they don't have to. They have up to 90 days to give it to you. And you say, the bank is doing this bad deed to me. No, they're not. You agreed to it. It's in the contract. Unfortunately, most of us don't read these contracts. Nobody ever told us about adhesion contracts. We don't know how to find a guardian-ward relationship. Never heard of it before. We're participating in it, but we don't know what we're participating in. So that gives you a little more understanding then of limited liability. That's not the whole story, but it gives you a little better understanding of how that game is played. Now, when we talk about freedom, well, let's talk about the Second Amendment's freedom and the right to keep and bear arms. It was done in a case called This is the Appeals Court of California, Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, and Bob Stewart's machine gun conviction. A guy by the name of Bob Stewart made his machine gun, and the BATF came out and gave him a ticket and hauled him in and prosecuted him, convicted him, and the Ninth Circuit overturned his conviction. And here's why they did that. A federal appeals court Thursday overturned a Mesa man's conviction, federal conviction of possessing 5 machine guns. A 3-judge panel of the 9th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals in San Francisco reversed the conviction, ruling that the congressional ban does not apply to homemade machine guns and their parts because they were never in the stream of commerce. This guardian-ward relationship is derived from the powers granted by the Commerce Clause at Article 1, Section 8. If you could stay out of commerce, Canaanite trafficking, you could stay out of a lot of trouble. You know that? All right, now there's one more little part of this story that we probably ought to look at. It's called the Limited Liability Act of 1851. Let's see if I can find that. Limited Liability Act. In 1851, our Congress came up with a new law. It says in the case of the New Jersey Steam Navigation Company versus the Merchants Bank, cited at 6 Howard 342 in 1848, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that under the common law, ship owners were liable for the acts of their ship masters. They were practicing strict liability. In other words, if a party were to ship goods on board a ship and something happened to the goods, such as being destroyed or damaged by the perils of the sea, the ship owner was responsible to the owner of the goods. The ship owner must pay to the owner of the goods the amount of the goods and what they were worth. If the ship owner didn't pay the debt, the owner of the goods could sue the ship owner and collect. If the ship owner failed to pay, the creditor could then file a lien on the ship, which was called a maritime lien and which does not require possession of the object. And that's what happened to the farmer who had the accident with the Acme drayage wagon. Practicing strict liability. So Congress decided in 1851 that as a result of the New Jersey steam navigation case, persons would no longer be drawn into ownership of ships because of the liability involved. Shipping on the high seas is very risky, and it was especially so at that period in history. In addition, shipping was the only means of commerce, and the above decision would drastically reduce commerce within the United States. As a result, Congress enacted the Limited Liability Act, codified at 46 U.S.C. 181, as amended in 1875, 1877, and 1935, 36, and also the Act of 1884, which covered the entire subject of limitations. The purpose of this act was to limit the liability for the payment of debts of persons who were ship owners involved in maritime commerce. And the act specifically gives limited liability on shipments of bills of any bank or public body. After the Limited Liability Act was enacted in 1889, the U.S. Supreme Court in Butler v. Boston and Savannah Steamship Company, cited at 130 U.S. 527, ruled as follows. The court said, but it is enough to say that the rule of limited responsibility is now our maritime rule. It is the rule by which, through the act of Congress, we have announced that we propose to administer justice in maritime cases. The rule of limited liability prescribed by the Act of 1851 is nothing more than the old maritime rule administered in courts of admiralty in all countries except England from time immemorial. And if this were not so, the subject matter itself is one that belongs to the Department of Maritime Law. Now, here's what happens with insurance. When you buy a life insurance policy, fire, flood, derivatives, auto, homeowners, whatever it is that you're buying, you bring yourself under maritime admiralty. A guardian-ward relationship in maritime admiralty. You divorce yourself from your Constitution and your Bill of Rights, and you create a contract. And this contract is regulated by statutes and judgments under maritime law, under the Commerce Clause at Article 1, Section 8. Now, devoid of these rights, you find that you have all of these officers knocking on your door and telling you that they want to search. That you have, for instance, the fire inspector knocking on your door, and he says, I'm in here to check your fire extinguishers and your smoke detectors. Then you have the OSHA inspector coming in, and he says that he wants to check the safety of your plant and equipment. Then the EPA man comes in, and he says, well, we want to see if you're killing any little froggies or doing anything like that, and we're going to regulate the environment and the environmental quality. And pretty soon you find that you're being regulated and controlled to such a degree that you can hardly function. Your business is being sucked dry of its profits and its funds by all of these administrators. And there's a reason for that. It's to put you out of business. And so as time progresses, the capitalist system, which tends to monopoly, is used against you, and it drives the little people out in favor of the big people. So if you take a look at the auto industry, we started off in 1900. By 1930, we had 2,600 automobile companies, and today we have three. And the viability of one of them isn't too sure. Competitive capitalism tends to monopoly. And the competitive capitalism of the Wall Street bankers tends to monopoly, and it puts power in their hands through the Commerce Clause to make you pay for their mistakes. They have the power to go to Congress and lobby to get legislation enacted that works well for them and works against you. In a guardian ward relationship in which they become your guardians and you become their wards, you pay and they collect. It is, after all, the American way. Hey, I'm about out of time. I'm going to have to give you a final reminder here that you have been listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. We're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org. Now, the law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school. It is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact desk, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly and has our radio log schedule and archives. And all of that can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. All right, our time's up. I've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station. God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.